In this book, we look at four sort of families or groups of approaches to apologetics. The four approaches that we discuss are known as classical, evidential, reformed, and fideist approaches. What apologetics does when it does it well is it helps overcome certain objections and provides evidence that Christianity is true, but it does not remove the reality that God is other, that God is beyond our complete comprehension, that God's way of looking at the world challenges us to the core, that Christianity is not a summons to accept an interesting philosophy, but it is, though there is interesting philosophy in Christianity, but it is a summons to pick up our cross and follow Jesus Christ.
Welcome to this episode of Apologetics Profile, a production of Watchman Fellowship, equipping you to give a defense for the hope that is in you. Who is my neighbor? Maybe they are atheists, Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, or Muslims. What do I say to them? How can I share my faith with them? Watchman.org has a wealth of resources available to equip you to better understand your non-Christian neighbors. Be sure to check out Watchman.org for more information. Here's your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
What is truth? Philosophy professor Richard DeWitt, in his 2018 work, Worldviews, An Introduction to the History and Philosophy of Science, notes that in trying to answer such a question, we often find ourselves faced with something of a problem of circular reasoning. Quote, "We think the belief that Earth moves around the sun, which is part of our worldview, is true. And the belief that the Earth is stationary with the sun moving about it, which is common in the Aristotelian worldview, is false. Within our system of beliefs, it seems to us obviously true that the Earth moves about the sun, and it seems to us there are innumerable facts that prove this belief to be true. But within the Aristotelian worldview, it seemed equally obvious that the Earth was stationary, and within that system of beliefs, there seemed to be equally many facts that proved the Earth did not move. What is the difference between our beliefs and their beliefs? If our belief about the Earth is really true, and their belief is really false, what makes the one belief true and the other false? More generally, what is truth?" A common reaction to this question is to say that facts are what make a belief true. For example, one commonly hears that there are facts that prove the Earth moves about the sun, and these facts are what make the belief true. Interestingly, facts and truth are often defined in terms of one another. People often answer the question, "What is truth?" by saying true beliefs are those supported by facts. And the question, "What is a fact?" is often answered by saying that facts are things that are true. In fact, no pun intended, my dictionary defines truth as, quote, "verified or indisputable fact," end quote, and then turns around and defines a fact as, quote, "that which is known to be true," end quote. But this sort of circularity, defining truth in terms of facts and facts in terms of truth, sheds no light on our questions. What is truth? What is fact? What is the difference between true factual beliefs and false non-factual beliefs? What makes some beliefs true and factual and others false and non-factual? End quote. More good questions. They are as relevant today as they were almost 2,000 years ago, when the first century Roman governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, looking into the very face of the Son of God, asks Jesus, "What is truth?" The Gospel of John, where Pilate's question appears, reveals that Pilate receives no direct answer. Of course, Jesus says elsewhere in John's Gospel that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through him. But how would you answer that question today? How have Christians throughout history attempted to answer the question, what is truth? Enter the rich intellectual tradition of Christian apologetics. Our guest this week on Apologetics Profile is Christian apologist, scholar, and author, Dr. Robert Bowman Jr. In this episode, we discuss his 2005 co-authored book with Dr. Ken Boa, Faith Has Its Reasons, Integrated Approaches to Defending the Christian Faith. In our discussion, Bowman outlines four key apologetic methods and surveys both their strengths and weaknesses. The book principally focuses on the methodological history and development of how Christians of different theological and denominational traditions have attempted to answer Pilate's age-old inquiry, and shows the relevance and influence of each method for our time. As Bowman and Boa write, quote, "Christian apologetics was forced to reinvent itself with the advent of the Enlightenment. The skepticism of Scottish philosopher David Hume, 1711 to 1776, prepared the way for this movement, which rejected all revelation claims and all natural religion or natural theology, and declared the autonomy of human reason. Hume convinced many that the teleological or design argument, the argument for miracles, and other standard Christian apologetic arguments were unsound. The German Enlightenment philosopher Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, who reported having been awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume's writing, likewise critiqued the cosmological and ontological arguments for the existence of God. These successive waves of attack on Christianity forced Orthodox Christians to develop apologetic responses. Such responses varied depending on the theological convictions and philosophical temperament of the apologist, as well as the content of the unbelieving attack." End quote. In short, the various methods of apologetics, despite their differences, all have a basic twofold goal in mind. One, to promote the truth of the risen Lord Jesus Christ, to give reasoned and logical arguments for the truth of Christianity, and demonstrate how Jesus is Lord of all. And two, to provide answers to skeptics' objections to the Christian faith. Bowman and Boa do not advocate for a fifth way, but rather offer a comprehensive background of four main apologetic perspectives that Christians have adopted over the centuries. Their book equips the body to continue the long-standing tradition of offering a defense for the hope that is in us with gentleness and reverence. As we began our conversation, I asked Dr. Bowman about his relationship with our ministry, Watchman Fellowship.
I was on staff at Watchman Fellowship in Alabama for a year and a half. I think that's how I got to know James, and I had, you know, an association with him, friendship with him over the years. We usually see each other once a year at the Defend Conference at New Orleans Baptist Seminary in January, and we've often shared the same campus guest housing apartment. When we've both been there, and so we've gotten to chances to talk and spend time together, and so we've known each other now for quite a number of years, and I've done some projects with Watchmen over the last number of years. I wrote some profiles for the Profile Notebook, things like that.
That's fantastic. Well, we want to get in today to we want to talk a little bit about apologetics up front. This book came out in, this is a second edition. It's called Faith Has Its Reasons. And if I were a brand new apologist or brand new to the field of apologetics, I wish I would have read this book about 10 years ago. It was really, really helpful in outlining the basic methodologies of apologetic approaches. I had not really been formally interested in apologetics myself until, the new atheism and the 9/11, and became more formally interested in it through William Lane Craig and his debates with skeptics and atheists, of course. And I think Bill Craig sort of led a new renaissance, if you will, in apologetics discourse. And so I got interested in that. And then when I became formally interested in apologetics and I went to Houston Baptist University and got my apologetics degree, lo and behold, I find out that there are all different kinds of approaches to apologetics. And I was like, wow, it's just like denominations. But your book was so incredible.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. It really does seem to be. You break that down well. You kind of make the associations in the book there. I was really sort of mystified and overwhelmed by this, not by your book, but in general several years ago, about the whole idea of there being different apologetic methodologies. And so this book is tremendously helpful in laying out the groundwork of how people have traditionally approached the rational defense of the Christian faith. So if you could just briefly for our listeners sort of outline the main methods that you guys talk about in your book, and we can go from there.
Sure. Well, I sympathize with your experience and puzzlement over these different methods and what's going on here. Why are there are so many different methods, and how do we sort them out, and where did they come from, and where do they agree and where do they disagree? Those are all common questions that people have and difficulties. And I myself, when I was going to Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, quite a number of years ago now, I had the same problem. I didn't understand where all these things were coming from. And so what I ended up later on, as I did the research for this particular book with Ken Boa called Faith Has Its Reasons, I took an approach that can be described as part historical and part typology or classification, trying to understand the different approaches in terms of categories and family resemblances among one another, but also understand them historically, where they came from, who these people were, why they were asking the questions the way they were asking them, why they were answering them the way they were answering them. And in this book, which is loosely based on Dr. Boa's doctoral dissertation, we look at four families or groups of approaches to apologetics. There are various names that can be used for these, and people kind of want to define the issue by commanding the vocabulary, and mm-hmm. So some of these are debated terminology, but the four approaches that we discuss are known as classical, evidential, reformed, and fideist approaches. Now, I'll explain what these are very briefly and simply. As simply as I can. Mm-hmm. Classical apologetics is so called because it does seem to be the dominant tradition in Christian apologetics from the early church fathers up through the present. It is an approach that heavily emphasizes what could be described as a two-step method. Step one, show that God exists. Prove what is called theism. Prove that there is a God who created the world out of nothing and who sovereignly rules over it and sustains it, providentially administers its history. So the existence of that kind of God in relation to the world, showing that by some kind of proof or proofs, arguments for God's existence, could be any number of different arguments, doesn't have to be one particular argument, but show that God exists. And then you've eliminated most of the world's religions from consideration, but you still have to adjudicate between, let's say, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Mm-hmm. So then step two argues that the God who created the world has revealed himself specially and definitively in the Bible and in Jesus Christ, so that the true God is the one revealed in Christianity as the one who spoke through the prophets in the Bible, and the one who became flesh and in the incarnation and revealed himself personally in Jesus of Nazareth. So this two-step approach is standard fare in what is called classical apologetics. Then evidentialism is a very similar approach, but it also has its distinctive way of doing things. Evidentialists agree that we need to provide proof or evidence for the truth claims of Christianity, but it favors what could be described as a cumulative or approach, or a cumulative case approach, where you're not trying to show first that God exists, and it could be, you know, of different religions, but just, you know, just God, and then prove Christianity, but rather you provide a cumulative case evidence based argument for the truth of the God of Christianity. So it's all in one shot, but with a variety of evidences that can be used. Some evidentialists like to use just one form of one specific argument, like the argument for Jesus' resurrection. Others like to bring in various evidences on various issues, but they're all trying to show not just that there is a God, but that the God of Christianity is real and exists and is the true God. Then the third category is Reformed apologetics. Now, this is, controversial that we put all this in one, but there are family resemblances among these different approaches that we put into this category. The best known of these approaches that are called Reformed apologetics would be presuppositionalism. Mm-hmm. There's actually three different forms of presuppositionalism.
Yes, I've discovered that.
So, but I'm not going to, we don't need to get into all that yet, but presuppositionalism argues that instead of trying to provide evidence that the God of Christianity exists, you argue that unless the God of Christianity exists, you can't even make sense of epistemological, issues like fact and method and reason and
right. Value. So that's why they call it presuppositionalists. You are presupposing something
right.
First.
Now it's presupposing. It's tricky though, because presuppositionalism, at its best, and it's a form taught by, for example, Cornelius Van Til, is not simply saying let's beg the question and just assume that Christianity is true.
Right.
Rather, what they're saying is, unless the God of Christianity exists, we have no rational basis for believing in rationality itself. Mm. We have no basis for confidence in reason, in logic, in truth, in fact. All these kinds of epistemological principles would be hanging in midair with nothing to ground them, nothing to make sense of them, unless there is a God who created the world out of nothing and is able to reveal himself and to make himself known to us as creatures in his image, and that's the God of the Bible. There are other forms of Reformed apologetics. Probably the best known besides Van Til's presuppositionalism would be the new Reformed epistemology of Alvin Plantinga and people like that, where it's a little bit different argument, but essentially it is still a Reformed or Calvinist approach to knowledge and epistemology and apologetics. Plantinga's main point is that there are certain things that we believe that we don't have to provide evidence for, because in fact, the whole enterprise of investigating truth and amassing and analyzing evidence has to start on the basis of certain givens, certain fundamental truths, certain properly basic beliefs, as he puts it. And he would argue that one of those is belief in God.
For Plantinga, the idea is without a properly basic place, something like an evidential approach requires, there's something that has to begin the process that cannot be substantiated by a further chain of causal evidence, right?
So we don't argue for the general reliability of our sense perceptions or our memories, because right. we would have to use them to argue for them.
Right. So at some point, just
something that we have to work with, and you don't need to provide arguments for them. And in some ways, it doesn't even make sense to try. Now, Plantinga is careful to point out, for example, that this doesn't mean that basic beliefs can't be challenged. If you can find something that proves that your belief that you're treating as basic isn't true, then that needs to be dealt with. These are called defeaters in mm-hmm. Plantinga's approach.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a defeater, hypothetically, to a belief that is being treated as basic. And if you find that it in fact is not true, then it obviously can't be basic. But Lanninga's point is that there are some beliefs that simply can't be disproved, and they also aren't susceptible to the usual kinds of evidential proofs based on things that are considered more certain or more fundamental than these, because they provide kind of the ground on which we do all of our thinking. And so that's a very similar idea to what Van Til argued, but Plantinga does it in a very different style,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Mm-hmm. But both are trying to avoid the Stephen Hawking euphemism of turtles all the way down.
Well, right. And all of these approaches agree that, you know, that needs to be challenged. It's just they're doing it in different ways.
Yes.
Then the fourth approach, which we introduce in the book with a reference to the Sesame Street song, you know, one of these things is not like the other.
Yes.
Is fideism. Fideism mm-hmm. is a kind of anti-apologetic view of knowledge and faith that says, essentially, you don't argue for the truth of Christianity, because that would be like arguing for why you should believe in your wife and love her. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know your wife personally, so that puts her existence and her trustworthiness beyond argument for you, because mm-hmm. you know her and you love her. And so fideism objects to traditional apologetics by saying that it over-intellectualizes or over-rationalizes what faith is all about. Faith is about a personal commitment to and love for God.
Mm.
And you don't give three reasons why I know that my beloved exists.
You know? right.
That's an almost direct quote from the main modern advocate for fideism, and that would be Soren Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard, yes.
The Danish philosopher in the 19th century, who was a contemporary of Hans Christian Andersen.
Mm.
And both Andersen and Kierkegaard used what would be called an indirect method of teaching. Rather than telling people what to believe, they told stories, or they told, in Andersen's case, literally,
yes.
he told stories. He told like fairy tales.
Yeah.
But Kierkegaard also told stories. He wrote books with characters that presented various perspectives on the philosophical and religious issues he was addressing. And they didn't necessarily always speak for him. they were ways of getting people to think about these different approaches and different ideas and shake people's minds. And
mm-hmm.
Kierkegaard famously once wrote that he had considered it his mission to make it harder to be a Christian.
Yeah, I read that.
Which is
the book.
Not what apologists want to do. They always want to make
right.
it easier, right?
Right.
Kierkegaard says the 19th century continental tradition was trying to pacify make more plausible Christianity, but in doing so, it was threatening the very integrity of the faith, because ultimately Christianity says some things that are very radical and paradoxical and shocking yes. to our rationality that God would become a man. These are not plausible claims. And so yes. Kierkegaard says, I want to make people understand Christianity is a radical, wholehearted commitment to God, not just a philosophy that we can reasonably adhere to, but doesn't change our lives radically.
Right. I had a friend of mine who had the opportunity to talk with Christopher Hitchens. And in a conversation, I think it's on video, but my friend shared with me that one of Hitchens's chief complaints about modern apologetics as he saw it, and of course he's an atheist or was an atheist, but I think what you just said reminded me of what he said. He's like, if you have an answer for everything, where is there room for faith? In that sense, that apologetics seemed to have made there being a philosophical or theological or some kind of answer for everything, whereas there's so much, we present all this evidence, it's so ironclad, there's no room for anyone to have any faith. I mean, it was a short-sighted
view. It's hard to please some people.
Yeah.
They criticize the Christian faith, you give answers, and they say, oh, you've got answers for everything.
Well, that's right. Well, of
course,
don't
you want us to?
Yeah, that's right. Of course, if we didn't, you know, they would criticize as well, But in a sense, it reminds us of the fetistic approach seems to be more, I'd say they're all centered on God in a different way, but Kierkegaard seemed to emphasize the very otherness of God. We didn't want to be too rationally or philosophically comfortable with the God of the universe. Would that be an accurate way to categorize his approach?
Yeah. I mean, we have to keep in mind Kierkegaard's atheism here. Mm-hmm. The main challenges that he saw were, on the one hand, the Hegelian philosophy that was trying to reinterpret Christianity to seem reasonable to modern man, and then on the other hand, the institutional church that almost everybody was a member of. I mean, if you were Danish, you were Lutheran. Pretty much by default, you were
right.
You were supposed to be a Christian just because you were Danish, and he saw that kind of nominalist form of Christianity in which everything is sort of culturally mainstreamed and doesn't cost you anything. He saw that as a threat to honest Christian faith as well. So. He's fighting a different battle than traditional Christian apologists who are trying to show that God exists, answer objections to the Christian faith. Kierkegaard wants us to understand that some objections actually get at the heart of what Christianity is all about, which is something that is challenging to a human's sense of autonomy and being in control and always being able to have the answers. And I do think that some people kind of wonder about us including this school of thought in a book on apologetic methods. But I do think it's important for Christians to remember that at the end of the day, what apologetics does when it does it well is it helps overcome certain objections and provides evidence that Christianity is true, but it does not remove the reality that God is other, that God is beyond our complete comprehension, that God's way of looking at the world challenges us to the core, that Christianity is not a summons to accept an interesting philosophy, but it is, even though there is interesting philosophy in Christianity, but it is a summons to pick up our cross and follow Jesus Christ.
Amen. I think it sums up you talk about Francis Schaeffer a little bit in the book, and there's a wonderful quote in there. Towards the end, around page 441, he says that man cannot make his own universe and live in it. And I think your book did a great job of showing the necessity or showing how apologetics demonstrates the futility of a man-made worldview and demonstrates the superiority of a Christ-centered worldview. I think that's a wonderful way that Schaeffer expressed it. Where did Schaeffer fall in to this camp? Was he more, he seemed to be sort of a combinatorial, kind of combined different methods to apologetics?
Yes, and by the way, your getting quieter.
Okay. Well, let me restate that again. So Francis Schaeffer said in the book, you have a quote from Francis Schaeffer that says, "Man cannot make his own universe and live in it." And I think your book does a wonderful job of showing how helpful apologetics is, not only for defending the Christian worldview, but for showing where other worldviews fall short.
Yes, and thank you. It's important to understand that not all apologists fit neatly into one of the four approaches that we've talked about. And in fact, Schaeffer is an example of somebody who didn't. He was familiar with them, and he attempted to bring them together and integrate them into a practical approach to defending the Christian faith that was both reasonable and personal. Schaeffer is one of a number of apologists that we discuss in the last part of the book, in which we encourage Christians to integrate valuable aspects of other approaches into their preferred approach. Now, some people who read the first edition didn't quite get this, or I'm not even sure if they carefully read the last part. They may have just assumed that they knew what we were doing. We were not advocating a fifth approach that mm-hmm. is better than the other four because it takes the best from all four and, you know, this is the right way to do it. That's not what we're about at all. If you're a classical apologist or an evidentialist, that's fine. We're not trying to get you to change. I mean, if you decide that you do want to change after reading the book because you find something that's even better, that's fine too. But we're not pushing one approach above the others. We're not pushing a fifth approach above the other four. There is no fifth approach. What we're doing is we're saying whatever camp you find yourself in or that you feel most comfortable in, that's fine. But learn from the others. Integrate from the other approaches, insights and even arguments that you can add to your arsenal, that you can add to your repertoire in order to have a richer and more broadly effective defense of the Christian faith. So Francis Schaeffer is an example of somebody who does this. It's difficult to pigeonhole him into one of the approaches, but he's essentially a classical apologist who has learned from the evidentialists, learned from the presuppositionalists, and even learned from the fideists. So he brings all these together into really what is, I think, arguably a version of classical apologetics, but a very rich one, a very nuanced one. And there are other ways of doing it. And so we look at other people in the book that are also trying to integrate other aspects, aspects of other approaches into theirs. And you could argue that this person's an evidentialist, or you know that person's a Reformed apologist. John Frame is clearly a presuppositionalist, but he attempts to broaden his understanding of it so that it can incorporate elements of classical and evidentialist arguments into his presuppositionalism. So there are ways of doing this that don't require you to, you know, kind of choose sides and you know, claim that your approach is the only correct approach or the only valid approach, or that, you know, this is self-sustaining, you know, complete approach. There probably isn't any such thing, partly because there's different kinds of people. There's different kinds of apologists, and there's different kinds of people who we try to reach with apologetics. Some people are very interested in scientific evidences for the truth of Christianity. Other people couldn't care less. So it might be helpful if those of us who like scientific apologetics learn other ways of talking with people besides providing evidence for the beginning of the universe or something like that, because maybe some people aren't going to be moved by that, or they might not even need it. There are a lot of people out there who say, yeah, okay, something must have started this. You know, it didn't happen by itself, but I'm not convinced it's the God of the Bible.
Right.
So being able to address different kinds of apologetic issues, and even addressing different kinds of people from who have different ways of thinking and connecting with truth, is a very valuable thing to try to cultivate. And we certainly, Ken and I, are not claiming that we're, you know, the experts at doing that, but we're saying one thing that, although I think Ken's very good at it, but I think one thing that we can all learn from is by listening to Christians who have different approaches, that'll help us, you know, in attempting to have a broader, more, you know, full-orbed way of defending the Christian faith.
Absolutely. Your book brought to mind, as you were thinking about, as I was reading the integration part of it, you know, C.S. Lewis, who was an Oxford scholar. He was a Christian apologist who was well-versed in the science of his day, but he also wrote Narnia. So he's kind of like the Hans Christian Andersen. He has that aspect of storytelling. He's very logical and rational, very akin in throughout all of his essays. He knows something about philosophy and science, but he was able to utilize a variety of different apologetic approaches, I think, which has made him as successful as he is. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I do want to make a clarification. There's a difference between different apologetic methods or approaches from a perspective of epistemology or theory of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between that and different media, different forms of communication. So stories need not be, you know, the province of only the fittiests, for example.
Right, right, right.
Although they could be. Lewis, I would classify Lewis as a classical apologist, but stylistically, C.S. Lewis and Norman Geisler are about as different as they could be, right?
I mean, yes.
some people really reacted against me putting those two individuals, for example, in the same category. Ken and I both agreed on this, that they were classical apologists, but they're very different kinds of classical apologists. Another example would be John Warwick Montgomery. He's classified as an evidentialist, which he would certainly agree is correct, but Montgomery was in relation to the first edition, was very unhappy about the fact that he wasn't in the same category as Lewis, and he regarded Lewis as a kind of mentor. Well, and Montgomery himself was quite interested not only in evidential arguments in the abstract, but in the arts and literature and
yes,
law and ethics. And I mean, he was interested in everything, still is. He's still with us, and he's still sharper than almost everyone else.
Wow, that's great.
So he's like, I don't know, 90 or 90 plus now.
Wow.
So a towering intellect in Christianity in the past century. But Montgomery isn't, from an epistemological perspective, necessarily in the same quote-unquote camp as Lewis. But clearly he learned a lot from Lewis, and he incorporated that into his approach, and they're very compatible in many ways. In fact, evidentialists very commonly use the same kinds of arguments for the truth of the Bible or Christianity as classical apologists do, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one
reason why that's so is because once the classical apologist is satisfied that he has shown that God exists, he uses evidential arguments to show that Christianity is the true form of theism.
Well, yes.
The arguments are going to be essentially the same arguments used by the evidentialist.
Mm-hmm. So there is
it's sometimes hard to tell, is William Lane Craig a classical apologist or an evidentialist?
Yes.
Well, it depends on what he's doing. When he's arguing for the existence of God, he argues like a classical apologist. When he argues for the truth of Jesus' resurrection, he argues like an evidentialist, but so do all the other classical apologists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because in fact, the arguments are basically the same at that point.
Right. So what we have, and what your book points out, I think, truthfully, is that methodology is a kind of underlying, undergirding philosophy. And what we're talking here is the ground level philosophical mechanics of method. So there's a philosophy that drives the method, that drives the content is about the same, but really it's a matter of Ford and Chevy or Honda and Toyota, really what we're talking about, different ways to drive around town, right?
We've gone from denominations to car companies.
I'm trying
to remember these analogies.
I'm trying to make it analogous for our audience who is first encountering all of this stuff. But I think right is
no,
that
that's a helpful analogy, because certain fundamentals that have to be the same in every kind of car will run, and that's true in apologetics as well. But there are also different ways of organizing and rearranging things under the hood, depending on the philosophy of the car company about how they want to do it. And so cars differ from one another, not only on the outside, but also on the inside. Yet there are certain fundamentals that have to be there in order for it to work. And I think that's true in apologetics as well. I think apologists, no matter what their method, have to do certain things, such as they have to make sure they're understanding the objections fairly and accurately before they try to answer them. They need to be more concerned about being honest and truth-telling than they are in winning the argument or defending their position no matter what. Mm. So the certain values and certain principles that are going to carry across in any good apologetic effort, regardless of one's method.
Yeah, and that's with the passing of Ravi Zacharias recently, you know, the importance of apologetics was brought to bear more, of course, because Ravi would emphasize that the person is more important than, I mean, you still want to make a point, but you have to keep in mind the priority of the individual as you're talking to them. So you're not winning the argument. Okay, you win the argument, but you lose the person. So if your car, if you will, is not accommodating to a guest, then it kind of misses the point, where the automobile becomes more important than anything else you're doing. We lose sight of the point and the purpose of apologetics. First Peter 3:15, of course, you know, exhorts us to do it to give a defense with humility and reverence or gentleness. And sometimes we as apologetics want to argue for our own position rather than defending the gospels. And so I think it's absolutely helpful to have your methods in place. It's your book also reminded me of the numerous teacher in services that I sat in as an educator in middle school and high school. We talked about the best methods for teaching reading, or the best methods for teaching mathematics or whatever. But in the end, you love your students and you convey your wisdom to your students through your care of them. And they're not just, you know, outlets into which you put your plug. They are a moral being created in the image of God that you develop a relationship with. And through that, you're able to teach them. But I think for a methodological, breaking down the methodological approaches to how we do apologetics, I think you and Dr. Boa have come up with what I think, which should be a foundational textbook in any apologetics course. And if I end up teaching apologetics, this is going to be required reading in no matter what I do. So it is a wonderful book, sir. And I really appreciate you guys and the effort it must have taken to put this together. How long did you guys work on this?
Well, I mean, as I said, Ken Boa did his doctoral dissertation on the same subject, and he had come up with this fourfold classification, which is only slightly revised in the book in terms of terminology. Mm-hmm. So, for example, he referred to classical apologetics as rational apologetics.
Yes.
Which isn't wrong. It's just most people that consider themselves practitioners of that approach use the term classical apologetics. So we defer to people's preferred terminology as much as possible.
Sure.
So he had worked on that, you know, I don't know how long he worked on his dissertation, but then I came into the project as far as turning it into a published book, and I went through everything firsthand, read all the primary sources, and did my own analysis of things, and eventually, you know, we came up with the book, and it took me probably 2 or 3 years. It was quite a long project, but I enjoyed it. I learned a lot myself. I like to write books because I like to learn about the subject I'm writing about.
Right. That's why we do it.
It forces you to make sure that you really know what you're saying, that you understand the issue well enough to explain it to somebody else. And I really get a lot out of that. So I learned an awful lot reading that, writing that book, and answered some of my own questions, and felt like when I was done that I actually understood Van Til, I actually understood Kierkegaard, mm-hmm. Etc. In ways that I didn't feel like I adequately had understood them previously. And again, part of what I was involved with that was learning the historical background, the cultural context of these authors, reading as much of their works as I could in their own words, you know, reading the primary sources. You probably won't be surprised by this, but there's an awful lot of people that talk about Kierkegaard who've never read Kierkegaard.
Yes.
They've only read what Francis Schaeffer says about Kierkegaard or what somebody else says about Kierkegaard, which isn't necessarily bad, but it is nothing like actually reading, you know, the original author. Just like if the only thing you ever read were biblical commentaries, but you never read the Bible, would you really know the Bible? Mm. Probably not. Mm. Even if it's a great commentary, because we need to read the original, the primary sources. You know, that should be the basis for our understanding. So reading people like Kierkegaard and Barth and Van Til and Gordon Clark and Alvin Plantinga, long chunks, and really trying to get inside their heads and understand what they were saying and doing, yeah. and why they were saying the way they were, was really important to me. And so I felt like I really learned a lot writing the book with Ken. And I think that this is why people have really responded positively to the book as something that's been very helpful. I think one of the key elements in the book that I insisted upon was that we, as much as possible, allow the authors that we're profiling to give their own exposition to, mm-hmm. there's lots of, you know, substantial quotations from these authors in their own words so that people can get to know them a little bit and feel like they understand their point of view.
Yes. Yes. Once the apologist has his preferred methodology, that he can certainly learn from by reading your book. The other important thing you just touched on was the idea of knowing the subject material that you are defending as an apologist. So not only do we want to have our method, pick our methods, we want to be able to make sure that we are at least somewhat conversant and knowledgeable about the aspects of what we're talking about. Because I see a lot of, I'm sure you have too, there's a lot of popular YouTube apologetics. A lot of younger people, a lot of younger generations are picking up on the idea of apologetics and doing YouTube channels and blogs and videos. And they're talking about heady subjects, philosophy and cosmology, yeah. and science. And it's almost it should go without saying that we really need to be not experts, but we really need to be aware of the kinds of things that we're saying about these other disciplines in which we are not per se experts. How would you address that to a younger apologist?
Yes. There's a tension and a balance that we're trying to seek within the tension here. Cause on the one hand, we can't all be experts on everything.
Right.
So, you can't wait to address issues until you're an expert on them. If the issues are relevant to what people are asking pertaining to the truth of the gospel.
Right.
So we need to be broadly conversant with subject matter. We need to be broadly conversant with subject matter that relates to the truth of the gospel, the truth of Christianity. We need to be familiar with the Bible as a whole. We need to be familiar with the, you know, science and history to the extent that we can be in order to intelligently address these kinds of issues.
Yeah.
Now, I think at the same time, most of us are going to have certain topics that we feel especially comfortable with, that we've spent more time with than others. And we should, you know, we should draw to from our strengths. We should play to those strengths and recognize that God's called us to address certain things, maybe more than we address other things. So there are some people that address certain topics that I'm glad they are, because I don't have time to be familiar enough with them to address them myself. But if somebody asks me about them, I know enough to give a brief answer or a simple answer and to direct people to resources that go into more detail.
Right. So there's
that's helpful to do. Sometimes it's just knowing where good information is to be found that's hard for people.
So it's good to be conversant. It's good to be able to translate. That's what C.S. Lewis, a wonderful essay I read in grad school at HBU, was Lewis's The Language of Religion. And he talks about the necessity of translating. And one of the things that I learned about his desire to write at least The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was to translate complicated philosophy into a fairy tale narrative, a genre, to be able to go from one genre of philosophy to another genre of fairy tale. And if he couldn't explain it simply, maybe he didn't understand it. So it was a great exercise in trying to, okay, can I break this down for the average person who does not share my interest in this or who doesn't know about this? And that's a constant, it's like, okay, apologists have answers, but we also need to be the best students as well. We need to be continually learning, which is one thing your book taught me. It's like, oh, I can still learn about stuff, even though I've been in this field for 10 years now. This was a great learning experience, and reading your book, I highly recommend it to anybody. So
thank you for your kind words about the book. Let me say this. Faith Has Its Reasons will do two things for most Christian readers who are interested in apologetics. First, it will help you understand the different approaches that are out there right now, and you'll have some understanding and some insight as to how they are similar and how they're different. And that's one thing that most people will get out of it who are interested in apologetics. But the other thing that it will do, and this may be just as valuable a contribution, if for some people maybe even more so, it will introduce you to numerous great minds in Christian apologetics throughout church history, from the early church all the way up to the present. It will introduce you to some of the great books that have been written in apologetics. And it'll give you in two or three pages, perhaps, what it took an author a few hundred pages to say. It'll give it to you in a kind of summary form, so that you have enough understanding of the book that you know why it was written and what it's about, and maybe what some of the principal ideas were that it advanced. And from there, you can deepen your own understanding by saying, you know what, that book sounds really good and really important, and I really want to read that book. So this book introduces the reader to the history of Christian apologetics. Again, it's not written in a chronological form, but in these major categories of approaches, but in each within each of those, it does give an historical overview. And with each of the authors, it gives you at least some background on them so that you know who they were or are and what they were about. So one way to think about it, because if you ever look at the book, it's a little bit intimidating in length because it's over 600 pages. But think about it this way, you're essentially buying an introduction to four dozen or so great Christian books in apologetics, and maybe more than that. And you're getting kind of a library of introduction to the great thinkers in apologetics throughout the past 20 centuries, all under one cover. And I think that's a valuable contribution. Again, as much as possible, we tried to let these apologists present their viewpoints in their own words, which minimizes our interference from our own perspective of how to do apologetics. We tried to let them speak for themselves. We do offer some exposition, some commentary, some explanations of the background. But if you read this book, you find out what these people thought, and you hear it in their own words. And then you also find out where you can go for, you know, if you are really interested in a particular approach or in a particular thinker, you can jump off that at any time and go pursue those.
A fantastic book. I read it. And don't be intimidated by the size of it, because I read it in about a week. Very readable. Love the dialogues that you have in each of the chapters that represent what a classical apologist might do in a dialogue with unbelievers, and an evidentialist would do, and a reformed apologist would do. You have these dialogues in there that are very helpful and useful to see how the method in practice might look with conversations with unbelievers. It was really nice.
Thanks for mentioning those dialogues. I am very glad that we incorporated those into the book.
Oh yeah, they were very, very helpful. In fact, a funny aside, and I was reading one of the dialogues and I was getting toward the bottom of it, I found my finger trying to scroll the page up. Like I was reading it on my iPad or something. But anyway, it's a great book. You can read it very quickly. It's a great background, a great introduction to the field of apologetics. And I myself personally found a home in each one of these approaches. I have oftentimes, without even knowing it cognitively, not even being conscious of it, using a little bit of this, using a little bit of that, using a little bit of this, but this book, I can go back and say, yeah, I borrow a little here, I borrow a little here, I borrow a little here. So even for somebody like me who's got a master's degree in apologetics, I still learned something from this, and I can still now better articulate kind of what I do and the different reasons for why I do it. So it's a great book for that, even for veteran apologists who've been in the
terrific
field for a while.
Thank you.
We hope you've gleaned some food for thought about defending your faith to those around you who ask of the hope that is in you. Dr. Bowman and Dr. Boa's book, Faith Has Its Reasons, Integrative Approaches to Defending the Christian Faith, Second Edition, is well worth the investment of time and resources to explore, especially if you are interested in the field of Christian apologetics. Next week, I will be continuing my conversation with Dr. Bowman about his most recent book, Jesus' Resurrection and Joseph's Vision, Examining the Foundations of Christianity and Mormonism. This book provides a unique comparing and contrasting of the significant historical differences between the extraordinary claims of the New Testament and the foundational texts and narratives of the Mormon Church. So we hope to see you next week right here on Apologetics Profile. For Watchman Fellowship, I'm Daniel Ray.
You've been listening to Apologetics Profile, a podcast of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated. Don't forget to visit our website at watchman.org for more great apologetics resources and materials. Thank you for listening to this episode of Apologetics Profile. I'm Dave Mitchell.